Hey guys, welcome to the Dominion Women's Health / We Still Have No Name podcast. Today's podcast is going to be on focusing on women's health and your first GYN exam or first visit to a gynecologist. At what age should you start and what happens with those visits? I'm proud to have my counterpart, Melissa, here with me.
Hey, Dr. Span, how are you?
So let's go through what happens in women's health care with GYN as far as exams and wellness and even not wellness. Like when someone's sick, do they go to an emergency room, a ready clinic, or do they go see their gynecologist? So we'll start off with what age?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. So I think there's a lot of questions, you know, moms wanting to know, and also just young women in general, just knowing when to come in, when they need to be seen, if it's because of a problem, because of their periods, you know, when should they actually come in and see you?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it's based on if they're having any symptoms or what's going on. But usually what we tend to do as a practice is once a young woman starts menstruating and having her cycles, she's pretty much eligible to be seen at an OBGYN practice. Have I seen patients that are 10 years old that have problems gynecologically? Absolutely, like with cysts that they're referred from an emergency room. But in general, for wellness visits, usually anytime after the age of 12. And what we tend to do in our practice that's a little bit different than other practices, I hope other practices in the country do this, but on the first visit, and Melissa knows, is I usually just want to meet the young lady. So the mom brings the patient in that's 12 years old just for a wellness check. We usually just talk. We talk about menstrual cycles, what's considered normal, what's considered abnormal with bleeding, cramping, pain. We also talk about, like, do you get emotional right before your period? Is there any some premenstrual syndromes, any pain with periods? Are you noticing changes in your body, hair growth, anything like that? So we talk about a lot of that, and it's just a discussion. And then after that, I listen to their heart and lungs. And then I say, okay, let's take this path. Let's do maybe some blood work to make sure that we're not dealing with what's big now in this country, finally, that people are recognizing it, is PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. And then I'll see the patient for her annual. What else do we talk about? We talk about Gardasil vaccines.
Mm-hmm. That's important.
Yeah, we're pretty lucky that the pediatricians in our market are pretty active in discussing HPV and Gardasil and what are the advantages and disadvantages. So we go through that. The other big thing I talk about with young ladies before the age of 21, when they're seen on a regular basis, we talk about the future. We talk about sexual activity, partners. We talk about contraception. We also talk about hormone control. A lot of times mothers are scared to put their daughters on birth control. And why is birth control important? It's a lot of it's just menstrual control. We're not worried about giving a patient a green card or a free pass for intercourse. That's not what birth control is main priority is. A lot of it's for bringing down the androgen levels, bringing down the risk factor for ovarian cysts, cycle control. I know, Melissa, you've seen some of the patients that we've had that miss school because of their periods, because of severe, painful cramping. So we use the birth control for that. Can you think of anything else that with the under 21 with bringing them in?
Well, I know a lot of the questions that moms will have when they schedule for their first appointment is that she needs to get a pap smear done. So I think that also might be a little misconception. Can you explain, you know, that as far as...
Yeah, I try to, and I think the American College of OBGYN covers it as well, is I try to avoid doing a pap smear on someone under the age of 21 that's not sexually active, because what are we looking for? I mean, we're looking for abnormal cells, we're looking for HPV or some infectious process. And if the girl, the young lady is not sexually active and she's under the age of 21, I think the benefit of doing a pap smear really isn't there. But if I have someone who's under the age of 21, has had sexual activity, has multiple partners, has complaints, absolutely, I would definitely do a pap smear. So I explain that to parents, and they usually understand when we go from there. The other thing we do is we can always do like markers for sexually transmitted diseases and stuff like that for young women that are sexually active. But the first visits are usually a get to know you comfort visit with the patient and especially her mother. And for us, we're fortunate in our practice that I would probably say 90% of these teenagers that are coming in, their mother or their aunts or grandmothers are already our patients. So we've built that rapport and confidence and trust with them. So that's an important factor.
Absolutely. I can see that. So what are some of the other questions that some of the young ladies have when they first come to see you?
I mean, I think the biggest thing young girls are questioning is, do I have to go on birth control? What are my birth control options? And the one big thing that I want to do, we're going to do a podcast just on contraception alone because there's so many different options out there. But we talk about birth control because a lot of the young girls, and even now I get a lot of it, patients ask me as they go, I don't want to be on birth control because I gain weight. And I try to explain to them that a lot of these contraceptive studies are based in the 1970s. Birth control has changed dramatically since 1990. If you look at when birth control came into fashion, the pill in the 1960s, I mean, you're looking at a pill that had 50 to 100 micrograms of estrogen. It could cause an elephant to gain weight. And if you missed a pill or two back then, you weren't going to get pregnant. You weren't going to have breakthrough bleeding because there was so much hormone in your body. So yes, there was risk factors for blood clots. There was a risk factor for stroke. There was a risk factor for cyst, weight gain. I mean, you name it, you were getting it back then. And then back in the 1980s, as birth control became more popular, the FDA came down on the contraceptive makers and said you can't make a contraceptive pill that was more than 50 micrograms of estrogen. And then in the 90s, you started getting down to the 20 micrograms. And now, I mean, we have birth control pills and it's a standard that's 10 micrograms of estrogen. So you're looking at 100 versus 10. So when you get down to 10, the side effects are a lot less than what it was back then. You're seeing a lot less blood clots. You're seeing hardly any weight gain, bloating, cysts, or any of that. You're getting a lot more cycle control. But with everything that's great in life, you got to have something that's going to be potentially not happy with. And the thing that it's not happy with the low dose pills that are out now, is that if you miss one or two pills, guess what, Johnny? Your hormone levels are dropping dramatically. You're going to get bleeding and potential to get pregnant. So the pregnancy rates for missing pills are higher now because it's less hormone in your body. But the advantages of less side effects, I think, outweighs it all. And the nice thing is back in the 1960s, when birth control first came out, and have you noticed I was going to do a contraceptive thing, but now I'm on this and I can't get off of it. So what ends up happening is in the 1960s, they were making pills called triphasics. So you had this crap like orthotricycline, orthonovum 777, triphasal. Everything had a tri to it. And when I was in college and in med school, I was like, what the hell does tri mean? So what tri meant was it changed doses every 7 days. So it started off at a certain level, went up, then went back down, then went up. So if you had a patient or a family member or a wife who gets emotional midway through her cycle and right before her cycle had severe anxiety, depression, or had spotting during that time, well, guess what on the pill? You're just going to mimic the same thing and make it worse. So back in the 60s, the guy that invented birth control wanted to mimic your natural cycle. So that's what he did. He changed the doses 3 times.
No kidding.
But for some people, it made it so much worse. The other thing that they found retrospectively, and no one wants to talk about it, were the side effects were a lot more. So if you had a risk of blood clots and you smoked, well, what do you think happens when you shoot a person up with hormones, then take it away, then shoot it up? You're going to have more side effects. So in the late 80s and 90s, we started having what's called monophasic pills. And now what you see with hormones is everything is the same dose. So what I tell a lot of women is look at your pills, whether you're taking hormone replacement or you're taking birth control. It's all the same identical dosage for the whole month.
Yeah.
So, and the companies that used to make these triphasics don't exist anymore. That's the crazy part. And now you've got other forms. You have the patches, the ring, and we're going to talk about that at length more and more. Just a quick thing that I always crack up about. Do you know why birth control pills, this should be a Trivial Pursuit. Do you know why birth control pills, when you open the pack, it has a Sunday start?
Why is that?
It's called male chauvinistic. The guy that invented the pill wanted you to start on Sunday so his wife would never have a period on the weekend.
Get out of here.
That's the whole basis of it. It's all a bunch of BS. So now if you look at birth control pills, what do they come with? A pack with stickers in it. So you change the day that you start. That's the whole BS behind it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. No one's
talking. Isn't it ironic that a guy invented birth control, though? I mean, I guess it makes sense.
Think about it.
Yep.
Can either be pregnant. Yeah. Not have, but no, I think the greatest thing about our healthcare in this day and time is that, number one, women are getting more medical degrees. They're taking ownership for their own health. I think that's the biggest problem. And I challenge anybody to prove me wrong. But if you look at healthcare in this country, especially, is women's health is so far behind everything else. And I think it's because no one has stood up and said, this is bullshit. I want this taken care of now. And I think now we're starting to see big changes in women's healthcare. We're seeing stuff to treat fibroids, your hormones. But if you look back 20 years, nothing has changed.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, you know, even just in the time that I've been with you, there have been so few changes up until what, like maybe the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
For medications and just different options.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have, like, to treat fibroids in women, we didn't have shit until 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. All we had was a shot of Lupron, which would shrink, but had a huge side effect. So I think things are definitely changing it for the better.
Why is it that it takes so long for women's healthcare to evolve?
Because in the past, women never stood up for their own health. They were too worried about their spouse, their kids, their everything else.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that hasn't changed, too.
No, but it sort of sucks that that's the kind of country we live in.
Yeah.
Where if you go to other countries, it's pretty much even as far as healthcare. I mean, when we talked about hormone replacement therapy, we're 20 years behind what the Europeans have been thinking of in women's health. So I think it's going to change. Where were we at before?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, back to normal health care and annual visits. So we'll move on past the age of 21. So if I have a patient who comes in for a new GYN and annual exam, even though we're completely paperless electronic medical records, you still get a stack of papers to fill out. And I'm still trying to figure that out for the past 10 years and still haven't gotten a clear answer. But in that information packet, we go through like your past surgical history, past medical history. We go through your sexual orientation, who your partner is. Do you have regular cycles, irregular cycles? What pills and medications you're on? So we go through a complete review of systems, which we'll put up on our website and our podcast for patients and women to look at. But after we go through all that, the patient's brought back to the room. We do your vital signs. So the big thing about doing your vital signs and blood work and everything is I like my patients to understand we're not only an OBGYN practice. We're patients become our primary care facility. So if I have a patient who's got primary care issues, we tend to manage them as well. So
to a certain degree, you're not handling any stitches for a cut on their knee, but
early on we were, but no, not now. I mean, no, you're coming in with chest pain. I'm not taking care of that. But if we have issues with blood pressure, we're having issues with anxiety, depression, which everyone in this country knows right now, to get an appointment with a psychiatrist is like winning the national lottery. So we tend to manage a lot of our patients in regards to that to a certain extent.
And I know you see a lot of thyroid dysfunction as well.
Yeah. I mean, in OBGYN, especially like now we're talking about this visit, not only am I listening to your heart and lungs, doing a breast exam, doing a pelvic exam to feel if we feel any ovaries, uterus is enlarged, we're doing blood work. I mean, I want to know how you are in that hormonal scale of life. Are you still ovulating? Are your ovaries working fine? We're checking your thyroid, like you said, because a lot of issues that affect women, surprisingly, are related to your thyroid. So hypothyroid can mimic depression, anxiety, skin changes, hair changes, weight changes, your menstrual cycle, infertility. It's crazy. If you were to Google hypothyroid, you'd go, oh my God, I got 5 out of these 10 symptoms. So, and I tend to look that up, especially when I'm seeing a patient for a first visit. And then we do it on a yearly basis to make sure their thyroid function is fine. And then we talk about menstrual health. I mean, how are you doing? It's amazing how, and Melissa's seen it before, how many patients come in and say, yeah, I have heavy periods, but they're normal. And I ask them, I go, well, how much is normal to you? And then I tell them exactly what normal bleeding, and they're mortified to realize that going through 15 pads a day is not normal when you're all having your cycle.
Or even pain, too. Like normal pain levels, I think, are completely exacerbated sometimes. So
yeah, and this goes back to, I call it, and I don't mean to offend anybody, my crock of shit statements that you used to hear as a young woman or a young man, like, oh, your grandmother went through it, I went through it. This whole thing about having a period and you have pain. No, God didn't put women on earth to have pain with their periods. So I try to explain to women that, no, you're not supposed to have pain during your cycle. And then we end up finding out they have endometriosis or fibroids. So that's a great point, is talking about your cycles and cycle control. And should you hemorrhage for 10 days? No. I mean, you should have heavy cycles maybe for 1 or 2 days, and then it slows down and then you're done. So definitely, definitely on those visits, we talk about it. And then we talk about just general health. We talk about your diet, exercise, cholesterol. So we want to make sure that you're going to be around for quite a while on this earth and you're going to be healthy at the same time. And then if I have a young woman who's under the age of 40 and we're talking about fertility, we're talking about future fertility, present fertility, just making sure that you're going to have the ability to conceive when and if you want to conceive.
I think those are all really good points. And I mean, speaking of just annual exams, so once you get beyond the age of 40, do you still recommend that women still come see you on a regular basis?
100%. So again, this is going back to people not paying attention to women's health issues. Like I have patients like 10 years ago that came and said, well, I saw that the news said that women over the age of 35 or 40 don't need a yearly pap. And I'm like, they're full of it. I'm like, okay, if you're with the same partner and you've never had an abnormal pap, yes, we can start spacing out your pap smears to every 3 to 5 years. I said, but has anyone ever questioned authority? Like we hear in this society, like we're supposed to comply with everything. Oh, you need a vaccine. Oh, you need a booster. Well, has anyone ever said why? So when it came to the pap smear, I was one of the big advocates on the Board of Medicine to say why. And if you look at the breakdown of it, why is it that they chose 3 to 5 years? So if you look at HPV, which is the leading cause of cervical cancer, the high-risk strands, it takes 3 to 5 years for HPV to transform from normal to high-risk or cancerous cells. So the assumption was, oh, you're going to see that patient within 3 to 5 years and do her pap. Well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Like if you told me, Danny, you don't have to get your teeth cleaned every year. Just see us every 3 to 5 years. I'm telling you right now, I'm not coming back.
Right.
I'm done, Johnny. I'll come and get my teeth cleaned when the tooth is falling out.
Right, right.
So what I tend to tell my patients, especially my patients that are having annuals, is I say, we're going to do your pap every year. Eventually, we'll space them out. But I still want to see you every single year. I want you, if it's not me, another provider, you need to have a pelvic exam done, do breast exam, pelvic, because it's really important. And Melissa, you've seen it in our office. We get 70-year-old patients, 80-year-old patients that come in with spotting.
Yep.
And then we find a vaginal tumor. And a recent patient that I saw, I asked her, I said, when was the last time your primary care or gynecologist did a pelvic exam? And she goes, oh, I've had all the kids I was going to have. So my doctor told me years ago, you don't ever need another exam. So I sit there, I'm mortified because if it was a male, he'd get an exam every single year. I mean, so it's sort of frustrating, but yes. And I tell my patients, don't listen to anybody. Get your mammograms done yearly. I don't care what anyone puts in your head, okay? It's about taking ownership of your own body and your own health. So we tend to do that. With that being said, is moving on to postmenopausal patients that are postmenopausal. I still see all my postmenopausal patients on a yearly basis, check their thyroid function, do their annual exams, their pelvic exam, make sure they have vaginal health, meaning that their vaginal mucosa is healthy, they're not having pain with intercourse or having increased bladder infections. Because a lot of primary care patients will send me patients with increased bladder infections, and someone will say, well, why is a bladder infection patient being seen by you? Well, the most common cause of UTIs postmenopausal is vaginal atrophy, where the vagina gets really, really thin because they're not producing any more hormone. So we give those patients vaginal estrogen to get that mucosa healthy. Because the crazy part is, and you've seen it come through our practice, is if you're in your late 70s, 80s, and you get a bladder infection, that can take you out of this world. So we want to make sure everyone is healthy. And with that being said, the postmenopausal patients, we make sure that your colonoscopy is up to date, that you've had a DEXA scan, and we manage your bone density. And if it gets to be where we can't get it straight, then we'll send you to a specialist for your bone density. But we want to be able to cover a patient from the time they start seeing a gynecologist at 12, 13 years old till the day that they're postmenopausal. So we want to cover all of that and cover the aspects of obstetrics as well. And we'll go through obstetrics with you soon.
Yeah, I think those are all amazing points. Do you mind just touching, you just mentioned DEXA scan. Can you just explain what a DEXA scan is and what age you kind of start recommending that and you start seeing issues?
So we tend to send patients over for a DEXA scan or a bone density that are postmenopausal. You don't have to take your clothes off. You lay on a table. It looks like an x-ray table. And it measures your femur. And some people do the femur and heel, but we tend to get those in the spine. So the ones that we send our patients usually get the femur and the spine done. And there's a formula that's calculated for your bone density and how much bone loss you're having. Now, yes, definitely a patient that's postmenopausal is going to get a DEXA scan, but is there young people that get DEXA scans? Absolutely. So let's say, God forbid, you had a hysterectomy with removal of your ovaries and you never had hormone replacement, you should get a DEXA scan. Let's say, for instance, the latest thing that people talk about, and I don't believe they're talking about it now, they should have been talking about it in the early 2000s, but we did a study when I was in residency on Depo-Provera, how I call it the devil drug. You take the shot and it prevents you from having a cycle for 3 months and getting pregnant. Well, it also causes you to get osteoporosis or thinning of your bones. So they were having patients in their 20s and 30s that had severe osteoporosis. So those are the patients that we're going to want to do bone density and DEXA. The fortunate thing for patients that are young that get depo and get osteoporosis is it's easily reversible. You just stop that, give them birth control, and let them get hormonally balanced. So unlike someone who's postmenopausal and is severely osteoporotic, it's hard to get that bone density back up.
That's really good information. So I know you had also mentioned just the breast exams. So at what point do you start doing breast exams, and at what point should women start doing their own breast exams at home?
I think you should feel comfortable doing a breast exam early on, like as a teenager, and working with your doctor as well as your mom or any adult that helps you in your family, of course, mother-wise or grandmother. But in doing a breast exam, I know that everyone's going to jump on this bandwagon and contact us through the podcast going, well, is breast exam really as accurate? No, it's not as accurate as a mammogram or a breast ultrasound, but it's something. And who knows your breast better than you? And that's what I tell my patients all the time. I go, I can do a breast exam for 5 or 10 minutes, but I don't know if that fibrocystic spot on the right side has always been there or it just popped up. So a lot of my patients will come in saying, hey, I was taking a shower, doing my breast exam, and I felt this spot. And I'll go, well, it feels fibrocystic, but I'll still send them for an evaluation. I think breast exam is the most important thing. And again, it goes back to me harping on the bullshit of women's healthcare and how we don't give it enough attention in this country. Like they say, oh, we should do mammograms starting at 40. I'm a believer that we should start at less. I mean, you've seen it in our practice. We honestly, I'm not even lying to you, have more patients under the age of 50 that have gotten breast cancer positive like biopsies than women over 50. It's crazy.
And sad but true.
We've had patients that are pregnant that get lumps and we send them for imaging. So I think the most important thing in women's healthcare that you're going to see besides hormonal balance is breast care. I mean, breast cancer is a huge thing in this country. And I think if we just stop focusing on the little crap in this country and start focusing on stuff like this with women's healthcare, I think we're going to see it get worse as far as breast cancer.
I agree. Do you feel like at least there has been some evolution with responsiveness to breast cancer awareness and treatment
options? I think the amazing thing, especially for us in Virginia, and I don't know what it's like for other states, but we've got so many imaging centers and breast centers now. And the reason why we have them is, think about it. We wouldn't have them unless there's more breast cancer.
Right.
Okay. But the nice thing is we've got some amazing breast surgeons and amazing breast centers that I think with the vigilance of providers and mid-level sending patients for imaging, we're catching this stuff so much earlier.
That's great.
That women are getting lumpectomies or getting therapy. I mean, I would say, and maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, probably 90% of our breast cancer patients do amazing
right.
with minimal therapy because they're getting caught early by the imaging centers. So I'm excited about that. And I think that's a big push.
Definitely. What about some of the younger women that you find, you know, you had mentioned like that they're fibrocystic breasts. So, you know, what would your recommendation be if you do have a young woman who finds a lump in their breasts? You know, do they contact you? Do they just go to their primary care doctor? You know,
well, I definitely want them contacting us and we'll evaluate them. We'll have someone in our office evaluate them and we'll send them for imaging. If it's the first, we'll do it as a baseline imaging. Then the nice thing is that we have a relationship here in Richmond with two or three breast specialists that we have an amazing relationship that I can just call up and say, hey, I have this young lady here. She has a family history of breast cancer. We've done the genetic testing, which was negative, but she's got this issue. On imaging, we see this or we don't see this. And they're always more than happy to sit with those patients, go through everything that they have, and also do an exam on them. So in some of them, they will do a biopsy if needed. But in general, a lot of times it's just having that reassurance and having that contact person that you're going to get a follow-up with.
That's really good. I'm sure that makes women feel at ease too. So that's really good.
Cool.
So other than, you know, some of the breast changes, so you had mentioned also maybe a pelvic exam is done during an annual exam. So I know that's got to be a little nerve-wracking for some of the young women out there that are, you know, going through their first exam when they get to that point. What can you tell them just to reassure them that it's nothing to be scared of?
It really isn't. The nice thing for us, if they were a teenager seeing us, they've already built that rapport or relationship with our patients in our practice. And this is just our policy. So I'm not trying to tell you that every doctor's office is going to do it. When I first started our practice, I knew that I was trying to build a relationship with a patient. So I would meet with a patient in my office. We would talk, go over everything. Then the patient would get taken to an exam room, and then they would change there. Now, because we're so much busier, the patient's put in an exam room, but they're not changed. They're fully clothed. So what I tend to do is I tend to sit with my patients, talk to them, get a good history on them, just understand what the issues are that are going on, and then I have them change, and I come back with the nurse. And then I just talk through it. I think the most important thing is communication. I mean, as I'm getting ready to do a pap smear or a pelvic exam, I'm explaining exactly what I'm doing and what's going to happen versus surprising someone and them going, oh my God, what's going on? So I tend to communicate a lot. And on the first visit, we tell patients all the time, I want this to make you feel like you're at a place where you can communicate. It's family. All of our patients are treated like family. So you have the ability to ask why. I never want someone to feel like they can't ask why.
That's really good. I appreciate that. What else? Is there anything else that you think would be really helpful for women to know just about an annual exam? What to expect?
I mean, I think the last thing I want to say, and I probably say it in every single podcast if you break through it, is just take ownership. Just take ownership of your body. It's your body. You only get one of them, okay? So always ask questions and always demand an answer. I mean, if that person can't answer you, And I'm more than happy to tell you, if I can't help you, I'm okay with you going somewhere else. But I don't ever want you to feel like you're not getting an answer. You want to be on the same page as your provider and feel like you're making progress. If it's an annual exam and you're getting started on a birth control, find out what that birth control is. Is it a synthetic hormone? Is it a bioidentical hormone? What are some of the side effects of it? Always know what's going in your body and what's coming out of your body. And I think that you'll feel better and you'll be more compliant. I think that that's our big thing in our practice is our patients have a great compliance because number one, they understand what's going on. And number two, I'm not putting you on something and saying, I'll see you in a year. I'm going to see your butt within 6 to 8 weeks and make sure you're taking it. Is there a reason why you're not and what we can do? And I think the majority of practices are leaning that way too.
That's great. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for all the info.
Well, thanks for tuning in. Next one will probably be on obstetrics. Thanks.